This is the Talking Split Podcast.
Welcome back, coaches, to the Talking Split Podcast, coming to you live from Zoom lockdown 6.0 we're up to at this point, or 6.1.2 it sort of feels like at the moment. They're being extended out like the iPhone updates. With me, I have via Zoom in Clyde, so we're not really too sure how this is going to play out for him. Ash Arnott, welcome, Ash.
It's great to be here. I'm on the new internet here, Robbie, so it should be nice and clear for everyone.
Excellent. Is that dial-up?
Yes. It's taken a while to get there, but we're in.
Excellent. And also with us, Jenny Screen, the high performance coach for the Vic Metro Women. Welcome, Jenny.
Thank you. I'm lucky I don't get any attack from you, so that's a good start.
Your power went out last time we did a Zoom podcast, so we're hopeful.
But I did sneakily, and I just popped back in, and I wasn't even a part of the question, so you didn't even really know.
Exactly right. No, you hit it very well. It's great to have you guys in. We are talking all things Olympics wrap-up today. So everything that we saw over the past fortnight or so, I must admit there's been a big hole in my life over the last few days with no sport on wall-to-wall. Lockdown did seem to be a little bit easier when we had wall-to-wall sport to tune into, in particular the high level of basketball that we were dealing with as well. So I'm sure everyone's aware of it by now. Our Opals lost in the quarterfinals. They bowed out to Team USA. Our men's jagged that elusive medal they've been chasing for a number of years now with a bronze with a win over Slovenia. Jenny, you seem like a little bit of a crier. Were there tears on Saturday night when we saw the bronze?
Yeah, well, there was tears in both games because I was devastated for the Opals for the quarterfinals. But then I was just as happy for the boys in terms of what they were able to do. You talk about that elusive, and you know, I think for most of them, I was with Patty and Joe and Nelly and Gorge in 08, and then again in with Patty and Joe in 2012. So you kind of go on their journey with them, and to see them finally get there, as excited as they would have been, I reckon their first emotion would have just been relief, like, oh, we've finally done it. The monkey's off our back. So, yeah, I think it's huge. I think it's huge for Australian basketball. And they finally got a medal. So, you know, we still rank higher in terms of opals and medals and stuff if we want to get into that competition. But I'm happy for Australian basketball.
Excellent. I like that you've still made it competitive. I enjoy that. Ash, what were your initial takeaways of watching that Boomers game on Saturday night?
Oh, it's how good defensively we were. Mm. Like, it was just so awesome to see. And obviously, we've had some great additions in Dante Exum, Matisse Thybulle, even to an extent. I know he didn't play many minutes, but you saw that defensive effort from Josh Green as well. And, yeah, it was just so awesome to see us be that athletic, defensive, disruption, menace team that we love to watch. And that was probably the biggest takeaway from just watching those Australian boys, because we know – how they operate in terms of the culture. Obviously, that's been big in the news and the way they operate and the way they play for their country. But, yeah, just that defensive mentality. And we knew we were going to get that from even just watching Brian Gorgian coach in the NBL this year with the Hawks. It was awesome to see. It was fun to watch, and especially to see him disrupt a team like Slovenia that was just an offensive powerhouse for the 2 weeks, and see us rattle Luka Doncic. I know it could have gone both ways, but just seeing Dante Exum getting his face a little bit and have that swagger about him. Now, like I said, it could have turned out really bad, but we got the bronze medal, so we're going to say it was great and turned out well.
To be honest, it's one of the few times I've actually enjoyed social media over the 48 hours afterwards. The amount of messages of support, just proud, you know, really happy for the Boomers to finally get there. Been some great little video tributes as well. Like, I know you shared one, Ash. I think it was like Riot Productions or someone like that put a little 12-minute video together.
I happened just to see Chris Anstey tweet it out, and I clicked on it, and I sat there.
He cried. What he wants to say, he did. Like, he got a little bit teary and emotional. And
it's funny. At the same time that Gazy spoke Saturday night, my brother just happened to be cutting onions. At the same time, exactly when I was watching that video, I said, Bryce, mate, quit it. But it just gave you goosebumps watching that video. And I, you know, I shared it to my social media on Instagram. I loved it. I sent it to my buddies in America and just said, hey, you know, when I was playing at college, they'd always go like, man, you Aussies are crazy. Got lucky to play with a few others, and just shared it with them and said, like, this is what we're about. And it was cool to have a 12-minute video there to really, I guess, show what we're made of, what we were brought up under watching. Just amazing. I had goosebumps. And, yeah, I did say to Jenny, I got a little bit of emotional. I didn't think you were going to share that, Jenny. Thanks for chucking me under the bus on that one. But, yeah, it was just
awesome. Vulnerability is important in life, Ash. Vulnerability as a coach.
And it was, thank you. And it was just awesome, I guess, then to the follow-up the next day to see it. Like, we just, the video was posted. And then you just saw it in like, that example on the court against Slovenia. And that's what, and I'm sure, like many other people, just yelling and screaming at the TV. Robbie, we happened to be just doing a group Zoom, and you saw how I was. I was an absolute menace, just absolutely celebrating. There's no words to really explain those feelings you had Saturday night.
No, not at all. It's huge. And the amount of people that tuned in for that game as well, like, that was one that was watched worldwide without question, but mainly in Australia, with so many young families, young kids being able to watch that, seeing what it was all about, seeing the celebration, seeing what it meant to them as well. I think that was phenomenal. So the hope is that this does spur on a whole new generation of athletes to want to play basketball, to want to achieve those things as well. And it's a great mark they've left on the sport. And the hope is, obviously, that the women next year get to go to the World Cup and in Sydney, I think we are, off the top of my head, and are playing for podium medals as well. And I think it's 2023, off the top of my head, that the men play their World Cup as well. So the hope is, and you heard Patty talking about it, like, this is the benchmark now. Like, we don't want to be talking about, let's just get a medal now. It's like, we've got a medal, now we want a better medal. Which is a great mentality to have, that growth mindset of always trying to achieve something a little bit more too. Certain countries played certain ways throughout. The cool part about any international tournament is you see different countries play different ways depending on their personnel, depending on their style of play and those kinds of things. Jenny, was there anyone that you really enjoyed watching, any teams or any players individually that you really enjoyed seeing over that fortnight?
On the female side, I loved Japan, and I love their coach. I think I respect anyone that can go, he's, you know, an American coach. Ash, what's his name? Is it?
I can't pronounce his last name. Tom Horvath. How do you say it, Robbie? I'm not the guy you go to for pronunciations, but Tom Horvath?
Yeah, well, let's go with that. Coach Tom.
Yeah, let's go with that. But I admire and respect a coach that goes to a foreign country, obviously being American, lives there, immerses himself in it, has been there for a long time, but also speaks the language. A lot can get lost in translation, and I think that was amazing. I love the way they play, the dribble drive action, the ability to move the ball quickly and put, other teams on the back foot. You saw that against America. Obviously, they just didn't have the height to go with it, and they were missing their center as well. But they were really good. I love them. On the men's side, I can never go past the French and the Italians. Like, I love that European style. I was in admiration of the way Italy played defense for most of the tournament. That first half, if you ever get the chance, if whoever's listening, like, watch it against the Boomers. They were absolutely phenomenal in terms of their scramble, their hustle, their, you know, face-to-face D on Paddy and trying to, you know, shut him down the best they could. And luckily for us, we adjusted in the second half. But I just love that style of basketball. It's a chess game. It's not I'm going to beat you with athleticism. They're probably the top three for me, France and obviously Slovenia. With Luka and stuff, but I think Luka showed his age in the final. You know, he was exhausted, refs weren't going his way and all those type of things. And then you realise, oh my God, he's 22. But Japan, I think the way they played, the way they acted and their coach just, you know, stole it for me.
Yeah, absolutely. What about you, Ash? What did you enjoy?
Similar to Jenny with the women's side, Japan. Like, they were just so awesome to watch, the way they moved the ball. They were cutting, constant movement, the way they shot it. Just as a team, they were just so awesome to watch, and the way they went about it. Yeah, they didn't stop. They never stopped moving. They never stopped running. But I loved watching the USA women's, a few individuals. I'm just a massive fan of Diana Taurasi, the way she passes the ball. Talking to Jenny last week, we had a VMPP session and we were referring to Diana with the boys. Like, did anyone watch the US Opals game today? Did anyone see Taurasi, the way she could throw a chest pass? And for me, I thought it was just awesome that I could refer to, Taurasi on the women's side to our boys, like, you got to be like her. And it was just awesome to see. and watching her, the way she would get others involved in the game. And then another one, and she was in the Japan team, but, and Robbie, I've spoken to you about Rue Machida. Oh, I loved her. Like, just a little energizer, buddy. She just went and go. Like, her transition from offense to defense and defense to offense was just unreal, and she was so enjoyable to watch. And some of the passes she would make, it was awesome. On the boys' side, other than I think Australia was probably the most fun team to watch. There's no doubt about that. And you speak to people around the world, they would say the same thing. You know, the Boomers were just so fun at both ends of the floor. But outside of that, and I think Slovenia for me was really fun to watch. You know, how Luka transferred to the Olympics. And I just really liked how some of their players played with Luka. Was the American's name? I'm just going to find it here. Was it Toby? Yeah, Mike Toby. I thought he was really awesome to see the role he took on and played. And then players like Prepelic and Dragic, they were really fun to watch. I tried to nail that one, Robbie, the pronunciation. I think it was close. So, Jenny, bad? How do I say it?
I like that you went Mike Toby first off. Like, you went the low-hanging fruit of a name that you can pronounce really well, and then you've just butchered everything since.
That's it. I'm just using numbers. Yeah, so number 7 for Slovenia was really good. I just like the way that they accepted their roles around Luka and the way they were able to spread the court and play hard in the final in the bronze medal game. You know, they weren't as enjoyable to watch. I think it was more around the way they complained the whole time to the referees, which, you know, we don't like watching that. But in those games before, they were just so awesome to watch how they worked off and the way Luka got everyone involved too. And you could see the joy that they played with. You know, their bench guys who weren't getting many minutes. It was the same with the Boomers. Everyone was up and about the bench. And when they came in, they gave their everything. And it was fun to watch those type of teams. And then further to that, you know, teams like Italy and these younger teams that had never been, seeing how they played and the way they defended and the pride they took in representing their country was really cool.
Excellent. Without question. Now, it's interesting that neither of you named Team USA as an enjoyable group to watch.
The women's. The women's were great.
The women were significantly better than the men to watch. There's no question. So with that, they've jagged 2 gold medals. They weren't overly enjoyable to watch. How do we close that talent gap between every other country and the US?
I don't know if you ever close that gap on the talent purely from, you know, the amount of people in population they have in their country, the depth of talent, the depth of athleticism from the gene pool that they have over there. I don't think you ever close that gap. I think the more time we spend playing over there in their leagues, the more time our females play over there or spend time grinding it out in Europe to get them to understand the international game and not see these people as superstars and in awe of them. That's how we close the gap. And then we just hope that the stars align on the times we do play them to make sure that we get as close as we can. And you saw that with the Boomers, like, you know, they played great, amazing for 18 minutes. And then, you know, one thing happens or it takes 2 USA players to just, you know, stamp their authority. Whereas for us, we need all 12 guys or the coaching and everything to be able to be perfect in order to beat them. But I think, if we can't beat them with talent, I think we have to beat them with IQ and we have to beat them with our culture. And that's, I think, for me, in my opinion, how we close the gap, because I don't think talent-wise we're ever going to. Yep. Unless we start a breeding program, maybe. Well, I don't know.
That would be an experience. Ethically questionable, maybe, but it would be an experience nonetheless. But I think you're right. Like, how do we compete with that level of athlete that is around that system for so long where they play such a highly competitive league? We're probably not going to beat the US playing like US. But that's the big thing to take out of that. We need to play a different style. What about you, Ash?
I cut you off, Ash. Sorry. You saw that with France. Like, they didn't want to get up and down with the US. It was a half-court, grinded-out kind of game. Sorry, Ash, I didn't want to take the limelight. I'll shut up now.
No, this is normal just for all the listeners out there. I completely agree with Jenny. Like, I think on the women's side, we have seen that we can close the gap on that athleticism and strength side. We've done it in the past. and I've got no doubts we'll be able to do it again in the future. For the men's, it is it's a little bit more difficult on those that athleticism side. Like we saw just in a couple of games with the US, you know, when they were in trouble, Kevin Durant just got him out. And it was a drive to that short corner, rise up as a seven-footer, shooting over guys like Nick Kay. And as much as we all love Nick Kay and the defense and how hard he worked, he just did not have the length or size or athleticism to stop that. And let's be honest, there's not even players in America that can stop him. So that's where I think it becomes difficult. But we have shown in terms of our style of play on both the Opals and Boomers, the way we move the ball, the way we play team defense and team offense, we can close the gap. The more athletes we get in terms of guys like Thibault and your Exums, yeah, it's going to help. But that skill level, like we were showing, like if guys like Patty, you can knock down that shot, you know, from that NBA three and have that range, then we become really hard to guard as well. So finding that balance moving forward, yeah, it's always going to be a tough one. What is it, 330 million population to 26 million? So we don't have as many chances to get them wrong. The US does, and you can see by their teams, I think they're, one thing the women's team has done really well is they've had that repeat, you know, Sue Bird to Rozzy, you know, now they'll probably have Griner and a few other Stewart that will come through and play at a few Olympics where they get consistency. But on that men's side, we're seeing such high turnover with who's playing for them. And again, Kevin Durant started, what was this, his third, fourth Olympics? I think it was his third, right? Yep. So you could see how he adapted to some of these others, like it probably wasn't the Tatum that we were expecting or guys who else, like Zach LaVine took time to get through it. So it was amazing to see the guys they did rely on were your Drew Holidays, your Chris Middleton, Devin Booker, guys who had probably more games, a style of game that could transfer to that European basketball style, that FIBA basketball. So that is always fascinating to watch. But, yeah, when they go to that ISO play, it's not very fun to watch, is it? Especially after you've watched those European teams just zip that ball around and 10-minute quarters are definitely a lot nicer. And you could, that was the commentary coming out of America. Man, we'd love this in the NBA. These games are quick, sharp, and fun to watch.
Yeah, absolutely. And, I mean, it's really interesting you talk about the ISO ball and the continuity balance. Realistically, I assume the men's USA team have to go to a lot of ISO ball because they don't play together so often. So they have to just rely on talent and what goes on there. Whereas the women's USA team, as you mentioned, they've played together a fair bit. That team has been, you know, two fantastic centerpieces in Taurasi and Sue Bird now that are five-time gold medalists, which is phenomenal in itself. Like
that's not bad.
Yeah,
it's not bad.
Like that's pretty good. Like it's a little bit easy to build around a culture that you know you're going to have some centerpieces and some things that you now just need to fill some gaps with, rather than trying to construct an entire team from the one spot. And that's where that USA team probably got a little bit of a kick in the ass at one of the Olympics and didn't go all that well. Or it was a World Cup, I can't remember which one it is off the top of my head, but then had to say, well, actually, we want a four-year commitment from people. We want to try and build a team around what we think can be really useful. And it was really interesting seeing like Kevin Love pull out and a couple of other guys pull out. They didn't go and replace them with superstars. They went and replaced them with people that suited FIBA basketball that can fit into a role. Like Keldon Johnson was huge for those guys. Like even the guys that came in from NBA Finals, like Booker, Middleton, Holiday, have literally finished playing in an NBA championship 48 hours earlier on a plane the next day. And it's that real sliding doors moment, I think, with a lot of it. The cases where if the US are maybe a little bit more cohesive early on, we potentially don't see them in a semi-final. They probably beat France in that first game and we have France in our semi rather than the US. So that's when you look at the tournament play side of things as well, and it's like, well, take care of your stuff, and even if you take care of your stuff, it may not work out for you. It's just unlucky as to what goes on. So you talk about someone that is really just a freak. Like, you talk about a Durant type. Like, how do you stop a Durant? And even on the women's side, Breanna Stewart, Aja Wilson, like, incredible athletes with phenomenal touch, an absolute ability to score and just fit into whatever's going on around them. How do you go about trying to disrupt someone like that is just hot? Even a Mills in that bronze medal game, like, had 42 or whatever it was. Like, how do you stop someone that is just on that hot streak like that?
I think it's hard. It's context, right? It depends on the player. Like, if let's say you're talking about the US and that's Kevin Durant, are you sending a double team to Durant? First, he's 7 foot. So he's going to be able to see out of that double team with a lot more ease. But then he's passing to Booker on the three. He's passing to Damian Lillard on the three. Like, they're just going to break you down. We saw, obviously, Luka Doncic. Spain had that mindset, you know what, we're going to make the rest of the other players from Slovenia beat us, which probably worked with Slovenia. But I think it becomes, you can take a chance, but I think it's all contextual with who are you trying to cut off, and then who are the other players that can damage you there. And we saw some people trial and error. But yeah, it's a tough one, mate. Like, you double team Doncic, or you box him one, and then someone else goes off. Everyone's going, well, what were you thinking? The plan just didn't work. It's a tough one, especially the Olympic Games. It's you've got to really back your defensive coverages in. I don't know. It's always a tough one. I struggle with this at youth league. what are you going to do? It's a tough decision. But I think as long as you've worked on it, right, as long as if it's in your bag of tricks and you've covered it, then you're probably going to have more confidence of executing that at that level.
Anything you do, Jenny?
Sometimes you just have to aware that someone's going to score a lot of points on you. I think perhaps, you want to make it uncomfortable for them as much as possible. And I think, you know, I spoke about it before, Italy did a great job of that against the Boomers in the first half, like made it miserable for Paddy, and really took them out of their stuff and whatnot. And that's what you want. So you want to have that disruption. You want to have to make them work and earn every single time they catch the ball. And that's why you want that dogger defender. Does that mean they're going to stop them every time? No, but then you just want to make sure that the other four pieces are doing their jobs. So it's okay for Durant to get off for his, 30, 40 points or Paddy, whatever. But if a few others join the party, then that's when it gets really tough. So you got to make sure you're trusting the system and whatever, I guess, your bag of tricks are, for want of a better word, to be able to negate or reduce the input from others. To be honest, I thought some of the D from the Boomers on Durant was also awesome. It was just that the offense was better. Like, not once did he penetrate into the key. Like, they kept him outside the touch points and the elbows, and he's out of the keyway, but it's just, step back, fadeaway jumper and those type of things. And you live with that. That's good D, to be honest. That's a tough shot. But then it's Kevin Durant taking that shot. I think that's where I would go. Negate the others, where probably the one person getting the job done, make it their life hell on every catch if you can, and make it earn it, and then see what happens from there.
And it's not easy to do. Let's face it. I mean, you can go in with as many plans as you want. Like, you can have plan A, B, C, and D. And I'm tipping that we were down to like S, T, and U by the time Gorgon got to the second half as well. It's like, how many different things can you throw at people? And short of the old Tonya Harding, Nancy Kerrigan solution, you probably don't necessarily have one. Like,
Ash is looking at you going, what are you talking about? I don't understand.
Women's ice skating, Ash. Like, Google.
I know. I understand the reference. Thank you, Jenny.
Oh, okay. Sorry.
You're making me sound like a dummy. I do that enough myself. Come on, Jenny.
But I mean, that's part of the fun of it, though. Like, it's interesting to see those guys go off and the girls go off for like those big number games where it's like, well, what's the plan? Like, what are you going to adjust? How is the in-game adjustment? And how is the in-game coaching going to change? Like, we saw a lot of teams like top lock and play high side of players just to make sure there was no catch. Okay, well, now you're opening up for back cuts. Are you allowing help on that? Are you having your big step across into the lane? Are you helping off shooters in corner? Like, you're going to have to give up something somewhere. It's not easy enough to just sort of sit there and say, well, we're going to let them have, 40. Okay, but if they have 40 and they have 15 assists, you're probably screwed. Like, you can't do anything with that. So it's really interesting to see. And it depends positionally too. Like, we saw Mariana Tolo go off against Puerto Rico, had a massive stat line when the Opals girls needed to win that game by 25 or 26 or whatever it was. But there's only so much you can do.
Hmm.
So
exactly.
So when we look at that, so we did see a little bit of junk defense thrown out there. We saw a little bit of box on one. We saw a triangle on two. I saw some people saying it should be a triangle on two with like two people chasing Luka around and just three other people just stand randomly on the court and hope for the best. Is there any merit in teaching those types of defenses in particular to our junior athletes and then moving into our senior pathways as well?
No, not at a junior level. Sorry.
But you don't have to, right? Like those essentially are still the foundations of your normal defensive plan. You can chase Luka around, but if you can't guard him and keep the ball in front when you've got like two people on him, you know, like it's and essentially that other three, that triangle and two, in the people in the triangle, that's just learning how to play help defense, how to manage your spacing, how to see where the ball and the people in your area. That's your help defense. And I think that's the big one with every style of D, any way we want to junk it up. It always comes back to how good is your foundation. It's the same with any offense. We can put in the world's greatest offensive set, but if your foundations aren't strong, if you don't know how to cut, if you don't know how to finish, if you don't know how to set up your player, it does not matter. So with that defense, it's at a junior level. If we teach our athletes how to play proper defense, keep the ball in front of you, have your position, you know, you're making sure your position's there so you can always stunt or some people have your positions, your help. Others are going to go a bit closer, deny and disrupt that way. That's fine. As long as we can contain penetration, contain the ball, because that was one thing offensively. The teams that did a better job of getting paint touches, whether that was penetration, through pass, posting up, they normally were the better offensive team. All right. Now, I'm not going to say they were 100% the better because we see it in different games. The analytics are not always going to tell the story there, but if you can't guard that, if you can't keep the ball out of the paint, you're in trouble. So it doesn't matter if you play normal defense, zone, triangle and two, box and one. It does matter. If you can't close out and contain, you're screwed. So there's no point teaching that at juniors. You've got to teach how to play proper defense. Now, I've gone on my rant. That way I don't get Jenny up and about because I know she feels even probably gets even angrier when we're watching juniors play defense.
Yeah.
Stop there. I'll handball.
No, I agree with you wholeheartedly. Like at a junior level, no. All about fundamentals, foundation, setting the base, and then you build from there. At an elite level, by all means, I'm all for box and one, you know, junking it up, triangle, and like whatever you want. But with that comes, you got to trust your system and trust the people that are running it to be able to execute it for you. You don't just throw it in and hope it's going to work. And that's why I love the braveness of those European teams, that they will do that kind of stuff and challenge other teams to think differently and offensively to be able to come up with different solutions because I'm locking up this person or we're making it difficult here, we're clogging up this position on the court. When I played in Italy, randomly I had this coach and it sounds like it's the stupidest thing ever, but it actually worked on the wing. We would allow wing drive penetration, open up our stance, allow it to get rotation, but the rotation would actually come from the baseline corner person, which we always say do not help strong side. They would come across and cut it off, and the person that gets beaten comes over the top and curls into the corner and takes their player. And you think of that and you're like, that's not going to work, but it actually worked quite well depending, again, contextually who you're playing. Because you lull them, they think they're beaten and they've got that corner person, but they don't because the other defender who's beaten comes across and tips it off. So I love the creativity sometimes that people are willing to do, and I wish we would do it more at the elite level. But at junior level, I'm all with Ash. Teach the basics, teach the fundamentals, footwork, pivoting, and then we can build from there.
But Jenny, those obviously two work because you guys understood around rotations, how to pivot, how to sprint out of that, how to talk, and it's what.
Well, there was buy-in, right? Like we bought into what the coach wanted us to do. Now, at an Olympics, there's got to be buy-in to what, let's say, the boomers, what Gorge wanted the boys to do. If there wasn't buy-in or they were second-guessing what they were meant to execute or what the coaching staff wanted to do, then it wouldn't have worked.
We saw that a little bit too. The boomers, like their ability to pre-rotate, like you could see them moving before the offensive player had even made the decision. They were on the ball. Obviously, the scout was on point. that they understood the rotation. So you could see this had been emphasized in their preparation. So by the time we were playing Slovenia and we had, what, 6-7 games under our belt, that thing was moving. So we're talking about the athleticism, but a part of that was their ability to read and understand what the offense was doing, get there on that pre-rotation. We were now able to run some of these really successful three-point shooting teams, like Slovenia, off their line and force them into shots they didn't want to take. And then I can't remember what game I was watching, but I think it was the gold medal game in the France-USA. USA started knocking down threes, and French were still going inside, and they were losing the math game there, you know, and USA just kept upping their points because they were adding 3 points every time. USA were adding French, putting French on the line. They were adding one every two free throws. Thank you, Rudy Gobert. And it was interesting to see that, and you could see the defensive plan coming together. That the US were like, we're going to win the three-point battle, and we're going to put you at the line. We're going to force you into these bad shots. We're going to help heavy on this, and we're going to give you that Rudy Gobert because we know over time we're going to win this math battle.
So with that, Jenny, that's a real interesting way of defending it, penetration for a start. How did you go with that when they got, like, was there any pushback from the playing group towards the coach of, like, what the hell are you doing here? And how did they get buy-in?
More from foreigners. So, like, because that's never been coached by us, you buy in quick over there. You don't challenge, especially when they're paying you, giving you your checks every month. But it's that growth mindset or challenging your norm or your thinking processes. And then just allowing it to happen enough to see that it actually works. Does it happen all the time? No, sometimes it broke down, but just like any defensive structure, it can break down. But it was fascinating and I really enjoyed doing it. And it actually worked. Michelini was his name, Stefano Michelini, when I played in Parma in Italy. And he was a bit of a cray-cray coach, coach men as well. But, yeah, just little things like that, little tweaks that you don't think of that probably don't come from your system but can make such a difference. But, again, I think it all comes back down to at that level, the buy-in from the players. And that's why I think at the elite level, especially at the Olympics, there's a lot of say from the players of how they think they should do things. Because at the end of the day, they're the ones out there feeling it and actually actioning in what the coaches are wanting. And sometimes you've got to make sure the coaches and the players are on the same page.
Yeah, absolutely. Really interesting. So we saw two very different gold medal games, and in particular with the personnel involved. So the women's side, obviously that Japanese team, which you've both spoken about as being a lot of fun to watch, very guard heavy, very ball movement, perimeter focused, was really their way of playing. The French team in the men's side, very much around Rudy Gobert, Fournier, on-ball screens, looking to pick and roll, and two very similar results, I suppose, in a lot of ways, in that the US won, you know, both reasonably comfortably, I suppose. How do you deal with not having necessarily the big on the women's side to go up against the grinders, the fouls, the Stewart, if she ever wanders into the post as well? Like, there are so many tools in there that really the US had at their disposal. How do you deal with not having a big to play against that? Anyone can take this because there's a blank look on both your faces at this point of, no, we're screwed either way.
It's hard. I think Japan did a great job to hang around as long as they did with Team USA because they played to their strengths, which was that perimeter game. They didn't fall into, oh, we're playing Team USA, so let's try and change things. They were like, no, this is who we are and what we do. Let's see if Team USA can do it. Now, ultimately, they were missing their main player, one of their main girls in the center, which didn't help. But it's tough. Like, unless you're growing, you know, the two centers from China who are 6'8" and 6'7", that ain't happening in Japan. So making sure that you're really fundamentally sound, that you're boxing out, that, you know, you're making every catch really difficult for Stewart and the like and Wilson, and that they feel uncomfortable because, you know, sometimes big girls don't like having little things around their hips and those type of things. So it can get uncomfortable that way, but, you know, and you just got to be hoping you're knocking down your shots, and, you know, because you're not going to win the rebound contest or it'll be tough.
What about you, Ash? Would you do anything differently?
I think you could see it with Japan. They did try their best and force. I thought early on they were doing a good job trying to force the USA into different shots. So you could see their heavy help from that low tag player. You know, Griner started hitting some mid-range shots. She was now stepping out. And they did, you know, they weren't shooting the ball in that first half. Great, the USA. It was just probably that offense event. They lost some momentum. You know, Japan missed some layups that they'd been making all week and some shots. Like they gave up some threes they'd been taking. You could see the coach were like, ah, like you could see his reactions on the side, which then hurt. And then USA could see the way they were guarding because they weren't being punished on the scoreboard. They were able to make some adjustments offensively. And that's when you could see it started to hurt Japan's defense there. So I think at first they found a way. They were like, we're going to go heavy on this post and trap it or front it and just put in that low tag and force that skip. Where I guess the boys, yeah, it was a tough one. Like you could see the France obviously wanted to punish the US switch. And early on, they did get punished because that perimeter D wasn't great. And then again, USA made that adjustment, ramped up that perimeter D, which helped the guy fronting or three-quarter fronting, which, again, then helped at the other end. And France went away, I guess, from one of their strengths, which was their ball movement, the way they play together. They went solely into, man, we got to feed this into Gobert. So I guess there was strategies to beat it. USA just had the bodies to punish that post player, where Japan, yeah, just obviously after US made their adjustments, it became a little bit more difficult. And once they got flowing, Griner was able to find those open players as well. So, yeah, it is a tough one. I think when you saw the whole week, people were making those adjustments if they were smaller bodies, like we essentially did as well. When we went small ball, you could see we ramped up that perimeter D to take away anything in the post to help out your Nick Kays and so on, who were guarding bigger in the post. I think that's all you can really do, just make life tough for getting that ball inside.
You spoke about the switching there, in particular the US. Like, they did a fantastic job against the Boomers of just pushing us further and further out of our offense by that switching. What's the best way to deal with a switching defense at that level? Because you can't always punish everything inside. You're normally switching like for like in those situations as well, and you're restricted by your personnel. What's the easiest way to help against the switching D? You brought it up, Ash. You have to answer it.
Yeah. No, I think, firstly, you can get that. If you are going to punish that switch inside, getting that high-low a bit more, like making sure bodies are moving, we're flashing, then turning, getting them on, you know, the back, especially if they're fronting. And the quicker you do it, the better chance, the higher success rate we're going to have. If you allow defense to move and take away that advantage from punishing the switch, then we're in trouble. I think slips. The Boomers did a really good job of this. If they saw a switch, they would slip it, keep that ball moving, keep cutters moving. So even if they didn't get even if they weren't able to punish the first side of the switching D, they were able to get them on the second side or the third side when the defense had to rotate two or three times. And that's when you saw the breakdown. It was the same with the US. How many times throughout the week, when the ball moved from side to side and teams were completing their full cuts, getting the ball moving, did you see a breakdown where there was two on the ball and someone was cutting and then they were able to get an open layup? We saw two on the ball a lot. And that's what happens when you're continually switching and having to rotate. So that would probably be my big one, is get that ball moving. The ball can't stick. Complete your full cuts and we'll find a breakdown on that second or third side. Yeah, it doesn't always go to plan. That sounded very simple.
Coaching is simple, Ash. Put it in one basket, keep it out of the other basket. We tend to complicate it in between somewhere, unfortunately, as coaches. But with that, I mean, Jenny, you've been in that situation a fair bit where you see constantly changing defenses. How do you teach the reads out of that to your players to make the right read at the right time in a high-pressure situation?
Yeah, I think what comes with watching at the elite level, you've obviously developed that over time through gameplay and stuff like that, watching a lot of game tape. Teams have systems and structures on defense and offense, so it's learning what they do. But then it's also understanding what you do as a player, because you know also they're going to be trying to take away what you're good at, right? So if you're aware of, you know, your strengths and weaknesses, then you can understand how a defender might approach you in situations as well. If you're in certain situations, like if you're a great shooter, they're 9 times out of 10, they're not going to go under. They're going to curl that. So what are my options off that? Rarely am I going to get an open three. It's probably going to be a curl off that and then creating perhaps a layup or an open opportunity for other people. But I think it comes with age and experience being able to read. I think at a junior level, we just have to provide opportunities for exposure to teaching them how to read defense, which I don't think we do because we've spent so long in the last few years only being good with the ball in our hands. So we're only reading what's in front of us. We're not reading what's behind us or to the side of us. So we're not acutely aware of how to read defense from that perspective. It's just like, well, they're in front of me. This is how I'm going to beat them. So I think if we give them exposure to those opportunities, like how to read a curl or how to read a flare or a pop action and stuff like that, will only help them. And then game tape as well. I think watching film is really important because unless they see it, they don't really know. They really don't. Because you could say, did you see that? They're like, yeah, but they didn't, because otherwise they would have made a different action because they're just telling you what they think you want to hear. So I think film is a great way of being able to hopefully educate them through that as well.
Most definitely. Like it a lot. So how come we don't see more zone presses at the Olympics? What is the reason behind that, Jenny? Why don't we see more of the 1-2-1 ones, the 2-2-1s, the 1-2-2s? Because we see a lot of it at junior level. Why don't we see it at the senior level?
Yeah, I don't know whether it's a fatigue thing. You can't even use that as an excuse at this Olympics because they hardly played any games. Like, it was probably the easiest tournament to prepare for because you had so much, I think you had too much break between games. But our team's too good now to be able to do that. I think sometimes you might see teams that are potentially on the lesser skill level and are just, scramblers will take that gamble to try and maybe create a few opportunities and turnovers. You'll see teams potentially do it if they need to take a gamble and they're down and they've just got to throw something at the gauntlet in the hopes to get a few stops consecutively together. I wish we did it a bit more, maybe off a foul shot, those type of things again, like we did see with box and one and junking up with different styles. But is it a waste of energy? Are we expecting too much of our players now? I think, 3-quarter D I think is important. I saw that a bit, but I think it was pretty much a half court grind out for most of the tournament, unless they were face cutting back Patty the whole way up the court. But yeah, it's a tough one. I don't know. I'd love to see it more though. Yep. But again, do we have time to practice it?
That's what I was going to ask. So Ash, do you feel like that's a good investment? Yeah. Is that a good investment into your training time, given you have a limited training camp with people that necessarily haven't played together? Is it a good investment to even look at something like pressing?
Yeah.
Not when you put it against the percentages you're going to run it. You saw some teams do a one-off, but those guys to go back to Jenny's point, they are too good. Yeah, they may get done on it once because they were like, oh, I didn't expect that. The next time they're coming down the floor, if they think it's coming again, they're too good. They'll just go bang, pass fake. They're finding that next option. They have the strength to skip it full court if they need to. So, I know the Boomers did a couple of reps here and there and we got a couple of steals, but you saw us once or twice and then they were like, oh, they know it's coming now. So we're going to change up our defense again and keep them guessing. So I just think the percentages, you're going to use it at that level. You may cover it for, a small stint in your prep, but it's not going to be a daily, let's cover this because this is going to be the base of what we do.
And I think your bigs are too good with the ball in their hands anymore.
Yeah.
You can, Joe Ingles, he played a bit of four this tournament and, or other teams, the whole point of a zone is, or a press is to try and get the ball out of the point guard's hands and delay the clock a little bit. But if you're just kicking it back to someone that's quite capable of either passing or dribbling the ball up, then it kind of, I think it is kind of pointless. So you've got to be, choose carefully who you're doing it against. If you've got a team that have, struggle with that four men bringing out the ball, four up the floor, then perhaps, throw it in there occasionally, and if they're guard dominant, then maybe you could do that. So maybe that's another issue why we haven't seen it as much.
We saw that too with the teams. Like, they were happy to take a pull-up three in trends. If they weren't pressured, if they were coming out of a trap and they felt comfortable, we saw it with Ingles and Boomers. The USA did it. Japan's women's team were doing it. You know, if they had that split second, that advantage in trans, and they felt they had a three, that was a good shot for them. They put it up. So that's the other part. You can't give them any time of day. If you're going for that zone pressing, you're giving up that pass with ease, making step into a trans three. We're being punished on that as well.
Well, that's the rise of the stretch four over the last number of years. Like, if you can't stick that ball from the perimeter, you probably have to be a five now and only a five. So the ability to hit the ball, you know, in that trail type position, like, how many times did we see it come down the floor, reverse to Joe, and it goes up? It's like, well, that's a good shot for us. Like, we're pretty content with that shot going up. So,
and even the fives though, Robbie, yeah, right? Like, we saw the rise of Baines at the World Cup last year, his ability to be able to stretch the floor and how important that was. And even this year, how many times did Landale this Olympics hit some massive threes where they sat off, like, you're the five, we'll give that to you. And he came up with some really big threes for us just because his ability to shoot. So it's just showing your five can shoot, you now become even more potent offensively.
No question. And Kayla George on the women's side too. Like, she does she's a phenomenal out of that on-ball screening action. She's looking to pop constantly to try and get that pick-and-pop three. So it is becoming harder and harder to guard against that sort of action. So one of the interesting ones that we saw coming out of the tournament, Delhi started the entire week. It got to the bronze medal game, and he comes off the bench with a very reduced role. Now, to be completely fair, we don't know if he's injured. We don't know anything that has gone on. This is simply a spitballing situation. How do you deal with that? Someone that's been a real mainstay of that team for such a long time, that has played such an important role, how do you get buy-in to then say, look, you're going back to the bench for this game, you're going to play limited minutes, here's your role? And look, he got stooged on an offensive foul call when he first checked in for mine, but, you know, different argument altogether. How do you deal in that situation with making sure everything's still okay? I would hope that the first time he's finding out he's not starting is not in the pre-scout meeting where it's like, hey, here's our starters and Delhi's just not on there. Like, you've got to have that conversation first. How would you deal with it, Jenny?
Like, you just answered your own question, conversations. And it happens constantly and often, and I think Nelly and John really did that really well, and Capes, they had really great relationships with all the boys. And look, I'm sure on some level Delhi and his ego would have been hurt. Absolutely. This is his third Olympics. He started for the majority of all his Olympic campaigns, and now he's taken a bit of a back seat and played 2.5 minutes. But what I loved about it is the way he responded, and now he's got a bronze medal around his neck, and I don't think he will ever, it will not be a thought of his, well, shit, I didn't play, like, I only played 2.5 minutes. And it's like, no, it's the three campaigns you did that got us to that point, that allowed us or gave us that opportunity to go for this bronze medal. And thank you for being so humble and gracious to remain a part of the team when it would have been hurting you so personally not to be feel like you were giving more. And I think that comes down to the coaches and the way they would have handled it. Conversations before, they would have prepped him early. I'm surprised it didn't happen earlier in the campaign. Ballsy move though, but he's probably one of the only players you could have done it to potentially on the team, because he is all about the green and gold. So I actually messaged Delhi yesterday and sent him that. I just said, thank you for being you, because I think he represents a story to so many kids who sometimes could be the star, they're playing, they're getting all the minutes, and contextually it's just not working. We need to make a change for the good of the team. And that was a great lesson in humility and putting the team before your ego.
What about you, Ash? Have you ever been in that situation as a player?
Well, that's a tough act to follow, firstly. My goodness. I have been in that position when I was at college. I must admit it was dealt with in a different way. Not from me, but in terms of the conversations. You know, I was the captain. I was playing. And this was post-back surgery. And in fairness, I wasn't playing the greatest basketball at the time. But I just went from nothing I went, sorry, from playing to nothing and no conversations. And when I did actually approach my coach and just said, listen, I'm not complaining. Tell me why and I'll fix it. You get any, I remember you hit me with the first time. He said, I forgot about you. I said, well, that is untrue. One, I'm your captain. Two, I sit next to you. My accent's very different to you. So you noticed me. I'm the loudest guy on the bench. You did not forget about me. And then once he finally saw through, I'm like, mate, it's not a complaint. Tell me what you need me to do. That's when it changed. And Jenny's right. You're able to have those conversations and people react better when you're honest. But you've got to sit down and make the effort. And having a relationship prior to that is really important. But we're also dealing, look at the person we're dealing with, Matthew Dellavedova. This guy would have done anything for the team. He never put himself above the team. And I think that's really important for a lot of our youngsters to understand that you're never bigger than the team. It's always the team first. And I think, yeah, we're talking about Dally, but you can even take it back to people like Josh Green. Like, this guy is in the NBA, plays for the Mavs. He could have had every right to be upset for the week. And unfairly, people probably judge his body language at times during the week. It's like, oh, you know, like, he's not interested in that. But you see then he puts out his social media and how much the Boomers culture meant to him and how appreciative he was of those, that time away, and how it's made him, you know, he feels like it's made him a better basketball player and a person. Like, imagine the learnings that guy got just from sitting there. And not once did he complain. Not once when it came to the end of the game, it was the junk minutes, did you see Gorge turn and go, Green, you're in? He goes, nah, mate. You know, there's only a minute left. No, that guy checked in, tucked in the shirt, and he played. And that's Dally. That's the culture. That's the mindset. And I think that's really important for our young guys to understand. Whether it's a minute or 20 minutes, you got to do what you got to do to help the team win. And that's where, yeah, opportunities arise. And I think in the end, it was probably the right decision, putting Thibault in. You could see what the idea was for him to guard Doncic. And I guarantee that conversation with Dally, he would have been like, yeah, mate, you tell me what I've got to do to get a bronze medal. And like Jenny said, it's the campaigns before. Because when he got his bronze medal, I didn't see him, you know, sobbing, crying about I didn't play. It was like, we did it, you know. Mama, we did it. It's coming home. So, yeah, it's just so important. And I think any tough decisions you make as a coach through relationships, conversations, and honesty, whether or not the player agrees with it, at the end of the day, it's going to be a better turnout than you lying or you like letting your star to know as you're writing up on the board, oh, yeah, Dally, forgot to mention, mate, you're coming off the bench. Like, that would have rattled not only Dally, but I'm sure some teammates. Like, whoa, what the hell? The game plan's just shifted. So, no, I think we all agree on the same thing. And in the end, awesome.
Right. Don't underestimate the value of him whilst he wasn't in the game, like his ability to sit there on the sideline and be an extra set of eyes or be that vocal person to Patty or to be able to talk the defense to the boys on the court. You cannot underestimate the other seven players that sit there and how valuable that is when you're out there on the court and you've got another teammate or you've got seven others there with you and you can feel them through that.
Standing the whole time. He was awesome. He was cheering. Yeah.
I didn't even realize he only played 2.5 minutes. Like, it's to be honest, I felt like he was on the court the whole time because he was always standing. He was always into it. He wasn't sulking at the back of a timeout or a huddle or anything like that. I was shocked he only played that little. But credit to him. Like, we wouldn't be in that position without him.
And what you love too, Robbie, in that 2.5 minutes, he managed to get a little elbow in, a little slap to the Slovenia's face in true Aussie style. Like, hey, while I'm on, you're going to feel me. Love it.
Big country represent. I like it. I like it a lot. Good Maryborough boy. It's fantastic. So, anytime there's an international tournament, or any tournament for that matter, the first thing I always look at is shooting percentages, which is always really interesting on my end. Free throws, 73% for men, 77% for the women. Too low, too high, where you'd expect it to be? What are your thoughts on that?
I think it's not too bad. I mean, I think you have to break it down a little bit more and who's taking your shots. Normally, they're fouling certain types of people because they know they're bad at the line. So that's always going to have a input onto what the total average data gives you. And then you've got to know that some countries are worse at shooting foul shots than others. And that's always going to bring the averages down. So, you know, I think 70% is pretty good, especially at that tournament play. even without crowds, there's pressure because there's so much at stake, and there's nothing that can replicate being at the foul line at an Olympic Games for a foul shot. There's nothing. So for me, I'm pretty okay with that. It's more where you're missing the foul shots in the context of the game that hurts you more than that kind of percentage for me.
Absolutely. I like that a lot. It's always interesting. Ash, three-point percentages, 36% for the men, 31% for the women. This is your field of expertise, shooting master.
I just want to go back to, and Jenny, totally agree, obviously, we've both played an Olympic game, so we both know what it's like to shoot a free throw. Just kidding.
Yeah, Ash was the guy that got fouled at the end of games. That's the only thing that's similar to what we're talking about here.
That's right, mate. That's right. No, obviously, for the women, we didn't shoot as well as what we wanted to, 31%. Obviously, always trying to shoot. We'll take over 35%. We're always looking to try and shoot over 40%. You know, if we're shooting over 40%, we're probably winning those games. So definitely an area I thought, just with the Opals, we were able to knock down the threes on the receiver where we didn't have to move much, you know, the penetration kick out. We were knocking those down. It was probably on the move. You know, the ones where we're coming off pin downs, we were coming off, that floppy action, or even the back screens off the flare, our ability to move and then knock down that shot is probably where our percentages started to drop and needs to be better. For the men, 36%, absolutely. We love that. And a few, obviously, we talked coming into that, a few guys shot better than we were probably expecting based off their NBA stats, Dante and Matisse Thybulle. They made some really huge threes and shot the ball better. Landale shot the ball better than we thought. Those percentages would have dropped, Paddy was getting them up, but we'll live with that because some of the shots he made were amazing as well. So you're going to take the good and the bad. We do have – there's been arguments over the last couple of years around Joe Ingles. When his percentages, he was the best shooter in the NBA for long periods of time. The last couple of years in the NBA, you could make that argument. He's one of the best shooters in the world. So having that in your team as well definitely helps. And 36%, we're going to take that, take the bronze. We'll get that up to 40. Hopefully that'll turn into a silver or gold medal. I'll leave that one with you, Gorge. You're the pro, mate. Make it happen. But, yeah, definitely in the Opals, 31%, there'll be a...
the Opals, or is that...
no, that was tournament-wide. That's my bad. That's across the tournament.
My bad on that one.
I would be intrigued to see what the Opals were. Do you know what it is, Robbie?
Not off the top of my head, I don't know. I just did a quick...
I don't think we shot well for the tournament. You could probably take into account that the tournament itself and the length of recovery between the games probably aided in probably some of the not for the women, but for the men in terms of, the shooting clip perhaps. I mean, I know these guys are used to playing every day and every night or whatever, but not being banged around. Like Luca was banged up by the end of the tournament. So, perhaps the recovery had the 2 days break normally, 1 day break between the games probably helped as well in terms of their percentages and kept them fresh.
Very true, very true. So this is the first Olympics we had 3x3 at. Did you guys catch any of it? How do we get better at that with our junior athletes? Obviously, there were no Australian teams there. Our men and women didn't qualify for it. But how do we get it to a point where if this remains in the Olympics, we get our teams qualified? What do we need to be teaching our junior athletes, Ash?
I'll be honest. I didn't watch it. Not having an Australian team in there, my interest in it dropped. I watched the pre-qualifiers with the girls. I watch most of those girls. Obviously, we know those well as Australian team, so we get behind them. But it's obviously a different game. Essentially, it's so much more physical. So if there's any refs out there, I'd love the VJBL to be a bit more physical because I think that transfers to both 3-on-3, 5-on-5.
I reckon you'd be really good at 3-on-3, Ash.
Me? I can't foul out, so that would work. The only thing that would kill me is the fitness side things, Jenny.
You might have a heart attack.
Yeah, there's no doubt about that. But definitely the physicality side, Robbie, is something we need to work on and get our players adjusted to. You can see there's been a shift for our seniors in NBL1. Like the game has been a lot more physical, it's actually been fun to coach in and watch. So helping our athletes there, that will transfer both to 5-on-5 and 3-on-3. The transition, like teaching our kids, and we see it, again, this is a five-on-five emphasis, but that transition from O to D, defense to offense, you know, that in three-on-three, you take a second off, you're being punished, bang. And I think we saw that too. You see that at a senior level when you've got better skilled players, smarter players. You can see that at the senior level. If you don't transition from O to D, that's a transition layer, bang. So there's two emphasis that I think we can do better in our five-on-five that'll help our three-on-three. But I think it's just more time playing three-on-three. Such a unique game. And the one facet of it is I love the coach player involved. There's not much. You can't coach while the game's going on. So it's now up to your players to think about what they're doing, the decisions they're making. That's the part I really love. They have to be quick thinking about it. So putting our kids in positions at their practices in your small-sided games, and obviously that's been a massive theme over the last couple of years, get your players in small-sided games, but creating drills where they've got to think on the spot. They've got to make decisions. You're calling your little timeout where the coach is not butting in and giving you ideas. They've got to come up with that. So there's some ways that within our five-on-five, we can help three-on-three. But then furthermore, you've got to get into three-on-three game situations, play in it, understand the speed. That ball, just getting used to that ball. You know, it's a size, what is a size seven?
Size six, but weighted as a seven.
Yeah, there you go. So just getting used to that. Like we always blame the basketballs, right? You shoot that shot, and you're like, oh, it's the ball. I'm used to a molten, I'm using a sporting. Well, now three on three actually has that legitimate argument. Like that ball is different. So just getting used to that, how it feels, the weight. That, you know, there's just little things we can change right now.
Yep. Anything you saw, Jenny?
Yeah, I watched it, and I'm torn. I'm very much a traditionalist, but I love that we still get a platform to be able to promote more basketball, even if it's in a new variety. It's tough. I think it's hard for us because we live so far away from Europe, and any destination for us to get to is at least a 10-hour flight. We need more competition. You could see that with the girls. We had limited preparation, limited game time against the Europeans, the Asians, because we had no funding, and it was a last minute decision and those type of things. So the more that we can, you know, hopefully get businesses involved that are happy to invest into the three-on-three, I think will be beneficial for both the men's and the women's program. And I think you'll see it at Paris, I'm pretty sure. My gut feel is that it will be there. I think it would have been an amazing spectacle had there been crowds. I think that's what gives it a bit of flavor, because when you're watching it, no one's there. You're like, oh my God, this is football. Like, it's a bit hard to watch at times. It's not very graceful. But I think had there been crowds and the atmosphere and that type of thing, it would have been a lot more enjoyable and probably easier to swallow for the traditionalists. But I think it's here to stay. And we got to get on the bandwagon because it's definitely going places.
Cool. It's a bit like cricket though, Robbie, right? Yep. Like Australia is still the traditional. We still love our tests. You've seen our T20 team right now. You know, we lost to Bangladesh.
Yep, not a great sign.
But then you look at the West Indies and they've said, you know what, we want to be that form of cricket. We're going down the T20, the one day is. And I think that's just going to be that battle moving forward in Australia. It's like we are a traditional 5-on-5 country. But then you saw these smaller countries representing there where they've got those two or three good players. And like, you know what? We've got a better chance of being a 3-on-3 nation. We want to go down this route. Then you just got the bloody US who, you know, sent over four WNBA players and they were fine. They're always going to have that advantage. But it was interesting to see some of the countries where you're like, oh, they're a basketball nation. Okay, great. They've gone, well, we've got a smaller amount. We can fill. We'll never be 5-on-5 powerhouses, but we can dominate the 3-on-3 space. So that's going to be, I guess, that battle for countries moving forward, and a big one for us. How do we now decipher through our players and go, okay, you're probably got a future in the 3-on-3. You've got a future in the 5-on-5. I think we just need to build bigger 3-on-3 platforms. Now the argument becomes, where do we fit it in our schedule?
Yep, absolutely.
Because right? We already play 365 days. A year. So, yeah, good luck getting that in.
No, very true. I mean, the cool part is outdoors, which is, I mean, you think about Paris, there's a number of outdoor facilities that would be fantastic little backdrops to a 3x3 competition as well. You know, put it in front of the Eiffel Tower, the Louvre or something like that. Very marketable. Mm-hmm. Come at me, IOC. I've got ideas. We can make this a huge thing. But I agree. And it was really interesting to see the makeup of the teams too. I really thought 3x3 would have no place for the five man. But
Like yeah. Some teams dominated with a bigger type because I think you get away with the physicality of the game because you don't foul out and you can be a bit more rough. That, yeah, they were embracing that big type of player, which was really interesting to see.
Yeah, it's not something I would have picked. Like, and the ability to transition from offense to defense, you now have that deep seal. You've just got to get your feet outside the paint and then get jumped straight back in. Easy points online. And as well as you've got to be able to stick the three or the two in 3x3 as well. That's super valuable. But that does wrap us up for this podcast. Thank you both for jumping in remotely. You've done a fantastic job via Zoom. None of us had internet cut out, which is a huge result, in all honesty. But
just with the dial-up, Robbie, no one's been able to use the phone line, so I'm
just is anyone going to call you anyway?
Oh, that hurt. That's not a great way to end the pod.
Don't play the sensitive card just because you think people are listening. It's not fair.
Just things. That's what I'm saying, Jenny. You know, I've got feelings. I am human. I'm just going to go cry, Robbie. I'll see you later.
We know you'll be on TikTok for the next 2 hours, making yourself feel a little bit better anyway. So no issues at all. Thank you both for jumping to the podcast. Coaches, we are hopefully going to be back on court very soon with our players as well. Make sure you do stay connected with each other and with your athletes, and we'll get back on court soon. Thanks for tuning into the podcast, and we'll catch everyone on the next one. Look, tune in and join the tribe on iTunes and Spotify.